I'm Quinn Murphy, and this is In My Chair.
A decorative artist who lives in New York City, John Darien is America's leading practitioner of decoupage, the art of cutting and pasting paper images. In 1989, the Boston area native founded John Darien, Inc. With a small atelier of artists, the designer utilizes color reprints of the 18th and 19th century images from his vast personal collection and pieces them together under glass, often in combination with reproductions of antique calligraphy. His handmade designs are sold at upscale home stores, in catalogs, and gift shops worldwide, as well at his own retail shops in Manhattan's East Village. Mr. Darien's artistry has been featured in publications including the New York Times, The World of Interiors, Elle Decor, House and Garden UK, Vogue, and countless others. The John Darien Picture Book was released in 2016 and quickly became a New York Times bestseller. John, welcome in my chair.
Wow, thank you. What a nice introduction, Quinn. Nice to be here.
I'm really happy that you came on because I don't know what you were thinking when I reached out to you as like a makeup artist wanting you on a podcast, but I love having all creatives in any form on the show to talk about how they got to where they are, what they do. So I'm really just excited to have you here, and I'm also a big personal fan.
Oh, thank you. It's cool. Yeah, I think everyone has a story. I think it's always sort of interesting to hear.
So you're in P-Town right now.
I am. Yep. 4th of July.
And you have 8 house guests?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Every year, Stephen and I have an annual weekend with a bunch of friends that here we are in July 4th. Yeah.
And do you like cook for them and make their beds and do all of that?
So, yeah, well, we don't make their bed. We make sure their beds are ready for them when they get here, and they make their beds. But we do, everyone takes turns cooking. So we have that's taken care of. And people sort of go out for breakfast and lunch. And so we just deal with bigger meals.
I'd be afraid to stay at your house and break something, you know, because I'm sure like everything is really considered and like perfect.
Everything's pretty user friendly. I mean, we have kids that come here. Thanksgiving, we have like 25 people here every year. And it's, you know, we hide a few things. But for the most part, I like comfort more than precious. So it's good.
So how do you get there usually? Because it's quite far from the city.
We drive. We got a car during COVID. But before then, though, I actually love taking the train and the ferry, train to Boston, then the ferry from Boston. It's really beautiful because you go up the whole coast. And then when you're on the ferry or in the water, it's really pretty. It's just nice because it kind of breaks up the trip and you can move around. Whereas sometimes sitting in a car for 6 or 7 hours is hell. But on the ferry and the boat ferry and the train, it's really nice.
I've never been to P-Town. I really want, I went in the middle of winter for one afternoon and I was like, oh, you know, I need to go in the summer and really like experience it. I want to.
Yeah. We love it all year round because, you know, off season, you can do things you can't do. Like, especially we do a lot of hiking and exploring in the woods and things. And it's much easier to do when it's not buggy and when it's less overgrown. So we do a lot of winter walking and hiking.
And less crowded too, right?
Oh yeah. There's like no one. Even in the middle of the summer, you can be in parts of the town and there's no one at the beach. It's kind of crazy. How isolated it is and how much beach there is here.
So you grew up in Boston.
Yep. I grew up in Watertown, which is a suburb of Boston, just next to Cambridge. Like I worked in Harvard Square in high school.
Do you think that you can see a lot of New England in your work or does that influence your aesthetic?
Maybe later on. I kind of grew up in an old house, but it wasn't about the old house. It was just about sort of life. My dad basically did the opposite of what you would imagine I would do, where he sort of took out all the moldings and lowered all the ceilings and paneled all the walls. It was the 70s, so they were trying to conserve and make things easier. But it was pretty ugly. I don't know.
You're like a preservationist before that was really a repurpose and reuse before, at least in America, that was really a big thing.
Yeah. I do remember being surprised, even at like a 10 or 11, when my dad was sort of pulling off the molding and putting in paneling about the molding why take it away? You know, things like that. But for him, he had a lot to do and it was easier, I guess.
I just realized that you're also Armenian, my deep dive. Did that play, did you grow up feeling very Armenian and did that play into any of your like view and aesthetics?
Truthfully, I was sort of always a little bit on the outside because my father and his family were Armenian and our name was shortened. So you wouldn't know. I mean, it was Dardarian, I think. And my mom was Scottish. So we didn't necessarily look Armenian, but we had a lot of kids in our town that were Armenian. It's a real big, it's a big Armenian community. And you know, the food is the thing that brings me, you know, tears in my eyes sometimes because I just, you know, that's my comfort food. But even in high school and stuff, kids didn't know we were Armenian. There was like Armenian clubs and stuff, and we didn't speak Armenian. My dad's family came from Turkey, so he spoke a little Turkish. But anyway, so we were sort of a little bit on the outside. Mm-hmm. And then sort of with my family too, I was a little bit on the outside because I somehow was like a creative person and sort of kind of a working class family that was like, what is that? Who are you? Kind of thing. So,
and then Kim Kardashian really helped you to get back to your Armenian roots, which is a lovely story.
Yeah. And Cher. Yeah.
And Cher. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Did your family come over here because of the genocide?
Yeah, they did. A little bit sort of at the beginning of it all, my grandparents came. My grandmother came first. They met sort of through the mail, I guess. And my grandmother came and then married my grandfather.
Do you think, this is so random, but do you think that like when people come out of kind of that kind of stress or dire need, does that end up, do you feel that like in any way in your family?
It's one of those things I don't think you can escape, but I don't think it was obvious that stuff, but I definitely felt my family, my dad tried hard to make sure we were like a normal family and American and all those things. And so much that I feel like it was sort of a reaction to his childhood. So and even though I didn't know that's what it was about, but I think deep down for him and for us, there was a little bit of that
like an overcorrection.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So how would you describe then your aesthetic? This is the most generic question. I'll start so you can kind of react to what I'm going to say. To me, it seems very like British, Anglo, country, early American.
That sounds great. If you could come up with like two or three words to describe me, I would, you know, be indebted for the rest of my life. The other day I was thinking, classic romance or classic romantic? Because I was thinking like I have a classic sensibility in the world and the images I'm connected to are definitely sort of classic and traditional. But then I love comfort and I am sort of a romantic. So it's all tied in together. I'm just trying to figure out.
Casual?
And casual. And it's like 30 years later, I'm like still trying to describe what I do. So here we are.
Well, I think there's a certain unfussiness or like you were saying, you like things to be lived in. And when I look at like the spaces that you create, they don't feel precious at all.
Yeah. I feel like I want people to be comfortable. I mean, I want to be comfortable. It's almost like I have a dog, but I don't have a dog. You know how we have this sort of thing sometimes in the shop where people are like, oh, I can't do that because I have a dog. And sometimes I'm like, well, maybe it's just that you don't want to be doing those things. Maybe you want to have a life that's a little bit more relaxed and lived in and that's okay.
Yeah. Stop blaming all your problems on your dog. I've tried
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Or just understand that maybe you're just with that person that doesn't really want to worry about those things. And that's great.
So John, you started your company like really organically, right? Like you were yourself making these, did it start with the decoupage?
It didn't. I just always made things as a kid, whether it was, and I've basically been doing the same five things my whole life where like I'll rearrange furniture, I'll make something, I kind of play act. I had a real crazy imagination. I was a real daydreamer as a kid. I would build, you know, forts in the weirdest places, abandoned buildings, porches, attics, eaves. You know, I was always exploring, always in a tree. Oops, I just digressed. Sorry. What did you ask me?
No, that's it. That's, yeah. What did I ask? I said,
you started the company. Yes. Really, So, I should make, how, what did I make? And I made, I just, I was making things. And then on the, when I was around 20, I was, involved with it. My sort of first boyfriend was this guy, Chris Bassett, still in my life, lovely person. And he was working in a flower shop and he had a lot of extra, materials that we would have around the house. And I would make things with them. And I remember we were moving and some realtors wanted to buy some wreaths I made. So that was sort of the first sort of accidental sale I ever had, because a woman was like, can I buy one of those? And I was like, oh, I guess. So then sold her a wreath. And then I started selling some things to some shop in Boston. And then I started working at this flower shop in Boston, but not doing flowers. I was making things with all the things that I was sort of recycling, like drying flowers and making wreaths, but it was definitely kind of bizarre. Like I was making swags with starfish. And then there I just started exploring. I started covering boxes of paper. I started doing collage things. It all kind of led to, it was mostly all one of a kind items. I did some painting, not very well, kind of Bloomsbury-ish, exploring. I learned sort of painted finishes for about 8 months in Boston with this company. And then I just, which kind of helped me more make more things. Like I used to make these trees out of buttons, which was something that I was sort of kind of well known for before I started doing decoupage. And then the decoupage was sort of just an accident. Again, all of it was sort of accidental and organic. I don't know how somebody guided me, because I had no plan. Even in high school, I didn't know what am I going to do with my life?
I was going to ask you, how did you feel about in those times, right? I'm assuming you're not making a lot of money. You don't really see where you want to go. So how did you feel? Do you remember how you felt about yourself?
I felt okay. Because I was making things, so I was continuing to be creative, it felt good. And then I had other jobs. I always had, and kind of feel like I still do have like three jobs. I always had sort of a variety of jobs that I did and I made things. So I always kept pretty busy. But I remember my dad, like at one point in my life, I must've been like 25 or something. And he was like, somehow he read somewhere that leasing a milk truck and delivering milk would be a good profession for me. And that's how, far from how disconnected we were, but it was pretty funny. I mean, I could still tease him about it, but I was just like, yeah, so me. Like, I think now, he turned
wasn't
around.
Like, you need to go to college.
Well, he wasn't really. And I went to a state school for a semester because suddenly they were like, are you going to go to college? I was like, oh yeah, what's that? You know, it just kind of came in from the clouds, applied to a school, got in, went for 3 months. It was not my thing. Yeah, so he was concerned. I think my dad was more concerned than I was. I just kept doing things. You know, I made things. I worked at restaurants. Everything seemed fine. I didn't plan anything. And then,
but are you like that now? Like in general, I'm always worrying about the future and what is going to lead to something. I'm so envious of people who are just where they are.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like I live day to day forever, and financially, and sort of a thing I knew how to do. But yeah, I never had a plan. Somehow I when I think back, I'm like, you know, I worked in a restaurant, I took tickets in a movie theater. I worked in a shop in Boston. It's just kind of funny. The restaurant thing really, was a big thing for me, cause I worked at this place called the 29 Newbury in Boston in 1983. And it was sort of like the college I didn't go to, cause it was all young people and it was a cool group and a really sort of delicious, sort of cool, chic restaurant. And I feel like I learned a lot when I was there. And then I started making things for the owner, which kind of led to my making things. It's like he knew I had made something. So I started making Easter baskets for him. And then I started selling those somewhere else too. So it all kind of stayed connected somehow.
And did it teach you about customer service?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And never leave a room empty handed. You know, like even in my stores now, I'm like, don't leave empty handed. You know, bring something back.
What does that mean?
It means if you're going to go into the kitchen to get food, you might as well make sure you're bringing something with you into the kitchen. And then when so that you're always doing something.
Oh, right.
And so I feel like I'm forever schlepping and carrying lots of things and not making like three trips when I could make one or two.
Well, people also are on their worst behavior when they're hungry at a restaurant or flying on an airplane. So like if you can placate to people in a restaurant, I feel like then you can do it anywhere.
Yeah. I have to say, like, the people that apply to work in my store, sometimes I'm like, if they worked in a restaurant, I know that they might have some good skills for dealing with public and being, you know, easily.
Totally. It's such a hard job.
Easily. Yeah.
So you opened your store in the East Village, right?
Yeah.
This was in the 90s?
Yeah. I was living in Cambridge and I started making the decoupage in 89. And then I did my first trade show in 90. And then I did and then in 92, I just decided to move to New York. And a friend where a friend was like, I'm going to give up my apartment. And I said, I'll take it. And then I just moved. And then I moved to New York and then I was doing everything out of my apartment. And then I needed a little bit more space. So there was a storefront downstairs in the Lower East Side. So I took that for a little bit. And then that I outgrew that. And so then I took, there was a space for rent on Second Street. And then when I saw that space, I was like, oh, I guess I could make it like a store in the front. And if I sell a plate a day, that'll help sort of, you know, the cost of everything. So that's
all you had to sell at that time was a plate a day.
I was trying to make up like a plate a day times 30 days would make my rent. Like I'm a real basic math person. So mm-hmm. kind of naive, I guess, in the business world. But anyways, it kind of worked. You know, I curtained off the shop and the behind the curtain was where we made things. And the front of the curtain is we had a little shop where we had, you know, some plates and some antiques. And then that just kept growing.
Did you make any mistakes?
I did okay. Things were running pretty smoothly. I did buy a bunch of clothes from this woman who I work with sometimes in Morocco and I buy like bedding and things from. And that was not the best thing I ever bought. But I remember selling racks of that stuff, getting rid of that stuff years later. But for the most part, you know, I'm pretty good.
So I wanted to ask you, anybody in design and people who just love home decor or go up, follow even home accounts on Instagram, no, when you say John Darien, you are a reference. We know exactly. We might have different ideas of what we conjure up in our imagination, but everybody knows what they're getting when you say John Darien. When did you start to become that John Darien in the design world?
I don't know. I opened my store in 95. I moved to New York in 92 and I opened my store in 95. And I was sort of lucky enough to get sort of good press from the very beginning. And I think I was sort of a go-to person. And now I think I'm also, especially people in all the magazine worlds, like I'm easier to kind of communicate with and, you know, check in on. So that sort of led to, I think, more and more press. And that led to, I think, my name getting out there, I guess. I'm not quite sure. I think that also just making a handmade product is, I think people sort of can relate to that itself. And I think they sort of start, I don't know, there's something about being authentic in a sense, authentic to who you are and what you do. And I think people sort of capture that. Like I'm so low tech that we finally did do some online, you know, we started doing e-commerce. I was like, who's going to buy online? It's such a weird thing, you know? And I need to see it. I need the shop experience. And it seemed like I was never going to figure it out. But then, you know, we did. And I'm always still impressed and surprised at people, how they shop online, because I don't still really shop online. But everyone was like, yes, because people know your name and they trust you. And I'm like, oh, interesting.
You know, it's so just you like always things- stuck to your aesthetic. I yeah. imagine, let me ask you this. So in the 90s, when minimalism and clean lines and kind of this like new modern came around, not everybody was into John Darien's aesthetic. I'm projecting.
Yeah, no.
Did you feel the pressure to streamline or to cater to that when that was the trend?
I didn't feel the pressure to that. I saw it happening all around me. I saw things changing. I saw people's sort of appetites changing, but it didn't change for my world. My world kind of still stayed.
And did you try to fit into that world thinking, oh, this person has this home, but this would look or fit into that aesthetic?
You know, not intentionally, but there was a moment when also like in the 90s, late 90s, I changed the shapes of the plates I was working with because I had to sort of work mostly oval, round, and octagonal. And I would do, at that point, I did a lot of painting and stuff to sort of create, you know, I was embellishing the image by adding sort of something colorful or a background or something. And then all of a sudden I was always about sets. Like a pair of this and four of that and six of that. And people could sort of decorate that way. And then all of a sudden, maybe around 2000, it was like, I started doing like single image things, no longer sets. And I started doing a different shape glass. It was a blown glass as opposed to tempered glass. And it didn't have the sort of classic shapes. So it kind of allowed me to do a lot more different things. And I think that shape glass does fit into the world more. It could be more sort of contemporary or modern.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but did you do that because you felt pressured to open up that part of your business, or was it just kind of a natural progression?
It was natural because I just like the, you know, the change and growth, and it just seemed like, what else can I do? What else can I glue on? Like, I was gluing on teacups in the beginning. I did all kinds of things that, you know, sort of compulsive and making things. So I didn't, so the new glass shape was sort of just like, oh, there's a new glass shape. I'll try that. And then I just did that. Just sort of like how I did, like, oh, I'll make button trees. Oh, I'll paint waste baskets, or I'll paint furniture, or I make lampshades. Like, those are all the weird things I did until the cool thing about doing the decoupage was, like, until the late 80s, everything I made was one of a kind. So it was hard to, like I had said before, like, my life was sort of day to day financially. And so I would make things, bring them to a shop in Boston, sell them, and then make more things. And that was sort of how I just sort of did things. But once I did the decoupage, I actually could repeat it, because the images, we reprinted the images. My first couple of plates were using the antique images, which didn't make any sense because it didn't really, the glue didn't stick. And some of those images cost like $100. And so you can't really glue it and ruin it. So anyways, the whole printing, reprinting thing was like a eureka moment.
Do you have to get the rights for the images that you then reproduce and sell?
I don't. I think anything that's over 75 years is was public domain back then. And then most of the things I used were well over that. But I also feel like the last couple of years, a lot of stuff has become public domain too. I'm not sure if you've seen any of that online. Tons and tons of images are public material now.
Okay. So it seems like an easy thing to do when you only need to sell one plate a day, or you're selling like individual things to people, you know, but as time goes on and rents are more expensive in New York, or you've scaled up and you have more stores, did that change the way that you produce material?
A little bit. I would say, like, in 1990, when I was trying to sell to Barney's, and I met with them a few times to show them my work, and they liked it, and I came back, and then I came back again, and the third time they were on the fence. And I basically stepped out of Barney's. I called a shop uptown that someone had referred me to called Lexington Gardens. And they said, come on up. So I went uptown. I had seven plates and I showed them what I had made. And they're like, these are great, but can we take these to a show and wholesale them? And I had no idea what that meant. And so they said, well, we're going to take these plates to a show and show them this, you know, plate, and then somebody's going to buy it for their store. And then anyways, real, again, basic math. And I was like, okay, sure. So they took my plates to a show, and then like that Monday I got $40,000 worth of orders, and that was the beginning of my life. Suddenly I had to like hire all my friends, I had to recycle boxes and things to pack stuff. We were just sort of like, you know, it was just kind of a funny, you know, fast learning kind of thing.
Were you freaked out?
I wasn't freaked out in a weird way. It was all kind of doable, but it was just kind of a crazy moment. And that was sort of the beginning of it. And then it just kept going. So it's funny, because I did so many other things before decoupage, I wasn't quite sure what the longevity would be. And every year I do two collections per year. And I feel like twice a year, I think, oh, maybe this is the last season I'll do this. Maybe this will, you know, people will not be interested, but it never changed and it just kept growing. So I'm still doing it.
Oh, I love that. Is that a boat in the background?
You hear that?
That's great. So when you're making something and you're looking through the archives or looking for inspiration, how much of you is thinking about, I just like this and I don't know if anybody else will, or how much of you is thinking about your customer?
I definitely think about I find images that inspire me, and then I think about what is it about this image that inspires me, whether it's like one detail or the whole thing, or So I try to do my best to share the beauty of the image. But there is every once in a while, like I do some really weird things. I still do, you know, kind of weird things every show. I have a guy that works for me for 30 years now. And when I show the collection, the two or three things that he thinks are his favorite are the things that do not sell at all because they're the weirdest things. So I don't stop myself from adding the weird, the macabre, bugs, you know, bodies, that kind of stuff. But it's not definitely not as popular as the other things. So I'm always looking because I like a range of things. I really like pretty and I'm fascinated by plant life and animals. And so it is still what inspires me. But I know what's going to be popular. Like, oh, that ladybug's, that ladybug is definitely going to be more popular than that, you know, grasshopper kind of thing. But I still do both of them because I like.
Do you ever have to do something because you know every year it just sells really well, but you personally are like, I am not inspired by it?
No, I will get rid of stuff if I feel like I have second thoughts about it. I do like to stand behind all of the stuff.
So I wanted to ask you about the balance as, you know, a brand owner about art and commerce. Is how much of what you do is strictly your vision and that's it and your sensibility versus running a brand and knowing that you have employees to pay and keep the lights on and that kind of thing?
Somehow it's still all my vision and I'm still lucky that it's all going smoothly, knock on wood, in a sense. You know, I don't, it's funny because this year I started meeting with a woman on Zoom like once a week to talk about what it is to have a business because I have no business training. And it is kind of funny. It's like a TED talk. She's great. And we just talk about silly things that I would never have known. Like if you make this much money per year, you have these many people and you need these many, this kind of people. And it's all still me. It's just me. I never took out a loan. I never had an investor. We made a little bit of money. I made a little bit of money. And then what we had saved, I would spend it on things that were a little bit nicer. And then that kept happening. Like I just didn't know how to even probably take out a loan at the time. So I just kind of managed. And luckily my vision has held strong and I created a business and I have staff and it's still working.
And there's so much talk in business now about like scaling up and growth. Like that's the magic word is growth. Yeah. Do you think, oh, well, maybe if I had hired a financial person, I could sell the company for $1 billion and whatever. Was that a goal of yours?
I never planned to do anything like that. But in these talks with this woman, there is that sort of bit of like, well, you know, if you want to expand or sell your company, it would be good if these things were in place. I would say probably during COVID, I feel like I work a lot, but I probably worked more in my life than I ever have the last 3 years because
really
a lot of staff sort of didn't come back. And then we had it sort of managers left. And then I had more responsibilities and basically we were like shipping, me and my boyfriend were like shipping like 100 boxes in the store at Christmas time because we had no staff and I had to rebuild it all again. And then the whole beginning, I was like, like I said, I'm not a business person. I feel like all my money's tied up in inventory. So I was like, what am I doing wrong? I need some direction. And so that's why I started looking out loud a little bit. And now I've been talking with this woman, not necessarily to sell my company or anything. I just would like it. I could use some help,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Was it scary? Obviously. I mean, obviously the world health aspect, but I mean, was it scary during the pandemic in terms of your company?
It was a little scary. I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen in the very beginning when I suddenly had like no open stores and inventory and suddenly we were going to stay in this thing longer than anyone had planned. But because I'm a home store, business was pretty good because people were sitting in their homes thinking, I probably could replace that broken cup that's been in my, you know, medicine cabinet for 10 years, you know, that kind of stuff. I need something to sit in that's more comfortable than this chair that I've been. It is funny because it's sort of like cats and dogs in fashion. Like people look a certain way out in the world, but most people don't know what your inner world looks like. Or like people that have a dog, everyone sees your dog and talks your dog, but no one ever sees your cat, talks your cat. So it is a kind of funny thing, like what people prioritize and what's important, not important. I think that maybe the you know, people being in their homes and thinking of refreshing was a good moment, because I think obviously, you know, taking care of yourself, enjoying your life, and being, you know, comfortable in your own home is huge. And sometimes it sort of gets lost in, you know, the world and working and socializing and all that stuff. So I think it was kind of a good moment for people to refresh their home worlds a little bit.
Did you have the pressure to do on a lot of online content?
I did find myself doing sort of funny videos and things with magazines and stuff, editorial stuff. Just more like tours of my house or things like that, which was fun and just not what I was used to doing. But yeah, mm-hmm. just trying to connect.
So I'm somebody with a really, I just had the podcast about dyslexia, and she was saying that dyslexics have really spiky intelligence. And that is where I'm very much like that. I feel like I'm good at things and really bad at the things that I'm not good at. Do you feel like you're well-rounded? And also, how did you learn the things like the finance, like even just filing your taxes and doing that, like if it didn't come easily to you?
It's funny, when I first came to New York, I got through artist friends, they had a bookkeeper. Her name was Reggie Waldron, and she was the first one sort of to not make me feel ashamed of my inability to do things. And she was just like, you know, you find the people that can do the things you can't do, and then do the things you can do. And it was sort of a common sense thing where like, you're not going to be expected to do everything, and mm-hmm. don't feel bad if you can't, and find other people to do these things. It's funny, I have a friend, Tom Delavan, and we were roommates in Cambridge, you know, in the '80s, and he helped me with my taxes 1 year. Cause he's like more numbers than I am. And then I feel like for the next like 4 years, I used his tax guy to help me through until my business got too big. And then when I came to New York and I hired that woman, but he sort of started it. My dad wasn't necessarily a real sharer of that information. I'm the youngest of six. We all have, I feel like we all had to educate ourselves about money. He wasn't that communicative.
But even now you are the boss at your company. Part of you has to manage other people. Do you enjoy that?
That's been the hardest part these last couple of years, just managing and staffing. And it's been very different. And what I was going to say too is like, I feel like I got through COVID. It was kind of tough and intense, and I just kept going. And then as things kind of got caught up, staffing just became just harder and harder and harder. And it's just like, I feel like we have ads, job listings, and so many things, and interviewing people and managing people. And it's kind of a HR. Not my thing. It's not my thing. I can go back to like the early, you know, around 2000 when I had a team that was very efficient and just did things. And we got things done, and it's changed a lot. I feel like I have got great people that work with me and for me. It's just like a different kind of person.
Do you have to reprimand people or ever fire people personally?
Yes. Cry.
It's hard, right?
It is. The first time I fired somebody, I cried afterwards. It was this guy that was making mistakes, but then he was also having a relationship with some of my staff. And I just had to be like, you can't do that anymore, because two people already quit. And anyway, so it was one big, you have to leave. And I just felt awful. I didn't want to fire anybody.
How would you say that, like, you are about solving problems? Because I know when you're a small business owner that things constantly come up. What is your go-to or your kind of MO?
I'm pretty good at just dealing with things as they come. I have to say, the thing about the whole COVID was sort of, it was like a video game. Like every turn, there was like another thing that you had to, or like one of those car things you drive where obstacles are coming at you the whole time. It was sort of like that. We just had to like deal with things right away, deal with things right away, deal with things right away. So I'm pretty good at dealing with things.
And in terms of like even manufacturing, like let's say you're designing something to sell in your home store, mm-hmm. right? Because you also sell furniture and
collaborations with other companies.
If you're like, I have to have brass hardware and now inflation, that's like, you know, makes the sofa, you know, too expensive and you won't make a profit on it. Like, are you good at kind of taking your original vision and compromising or making it work? Or how do you deal with stuff like that?
We had to do that during COVID where like there are things that we were making that we really had no margins or were really making any money on them. Like we make a paperweight that's very popular. We make a lot of them. But it wasn't where we made any money on them. And even if we made volume, it was sort of tricky. So I raised all of our prices during COVID, and my thoughts were, we have to survive. We have to do this. It's a handmade product. People will have to understand. And then people did. So it worked out. Some smaller items got more expensive and the larger items kind of stayed the prices they were. So.
But do you feel like you're generally like attached to your vision or an idea, or are you more like, oh, well then we'll switch this and do something else?
Yeah. It's all juggling for me, and money's always been kind of a juggling thing too. And I make those decisions that way. Like, oh, I want to produce some melamine, but then that's like, oh, we have to order 10,000 of that thing. If we order 10,000, this is the price it's going to be. And then where do we store it? So those are things that I if we have the money, I'll do it. You know, if we have the space, I'll do it. If we don't have the money or the space, then I'll do something else. I guess.
John, so what, like, can you break down kind of what your like work life, like how do you split your time between things?
Well, on Second Street, I have 3 shops. And then also on Second Street, I have a little personal studio. And in front of that studio is our shipping area. And then on a few blocks away, I have another studio that's like 4,000 square feet with like 20 employees that make everything.
Wow.
So like a Tuesdays and Thursdays, I kind of go, I'll start at my, where we make everything studio. Then I'll backtrack to my personal studio and have an assistant there, and I'll do check in on him and on that stuff. Then I check in on the stores. I'm in the stores a lot more these last few years, just managing wise and just keeping things afloat. I mean, you could have seen me any day at Christmas time dealing with a rope and letting people in and out of my store for the last 3 years. Cause we have a lot of Christmas business. And it was just, we couldn't have the stores be crowded because of COVID. And then when that sort of changed, we just still kept it a little bit limited, which is great for a small store. People wait, it's not too long. And then they come in and they feel like they have a better experience because it's not crowded. Anyways, did I even answer what you just said?
Yeah. So you're still very involved in the actual store, like how your store feels and runs, like
I am
kind of local level.
Yeah. I am kind of everything. I am the visual department. So if things sell and my staff keeps everything looking good. But if somebody buys a piece of like an antique or piece of furniture, then things have to shift around. So I'm sort of there for that. I'm the buyer. So make sure we have all that. So I know what's coming. I am a kind of a kook because I kind of have to see everything. Like even in my own personal studio, I have piles that sit at my desk for like 10 years and I'll go through them regularly and I'll just leave them there because if I put them away, I will totally forget about them. So even in my stores, a lot is visible to me. We don't have a POS system. If you can believe it, we're working on it. But all the inventory is in sort of my brain and my staff's brain. Like I can tell you kind of roughly what we have in stock. Which is maybe a little Rain Man of me, but it's also like not that healthy either because now that we have web and web has, you know, take some of that stock, it's, you know, we have to be more on top of it.
And are you really particular about the way that things are displayed?
Yeah, I want I want people to enjoy the experience. I want to make sure things are, you see the items and that you sort of can relate to them, or there's some animation involved. I set up the stores and rearrange it, all the things, and then we keep it and that way. And then I'll just decide to change the store around, and then we'll have it that way. Like I said, as a kid, I moved furniture around. I'm still doing it.
And you do that in your home as well?
Yes, as much as I can. Even if
I noticed you had a banquette in Provincetown and it was wrapped in some fabric, and then it looked like you had changed it. Like, how much do you change even like the furniture, or is it just moving around what you already have?
We have three main rooms here, and I've definitely moved I've swapped the three rooms a few times. I had a table here that I really love, but it was like too leggy and low, and I've had it for like 12 years. And for 12 years, I was like, I need a better table. I love this table. I couldn't let it go. We could also play ping pong on it. And we finally swapped it out like 2 years ago with a round table. And that table now lives in New York in my shop. And every time I look at the table in my shop, I'm like, oh, I should bring it back to Provincetown. Even though I complained about it for 12 years and it was leggy and low, I'd still love the table. It's a funny thing. I get that way with the images that I find and things where I might have a reaction to it, which could be sort of sentimental or psychic. I don't know, but there's some things that even my house in Provincetown, when I saw it, it's just the way it all happened was just like I was here. I saw the house, it had a for sale sign. I didn't have any money. I wasn't looking at buying anything. I hadn't been to Provincetown in 5 years. And then I took a video of the house, and then my phone kept jamming and the video kept playing. And then months later, I Googled houses in Provincetown, and then my house appeared on the screen. Like, I guess it didn't sell. Anyways, I'm really digressing. Sorry.
So when you look at a space in your house, are you moving things around because you think one day you're going to get it perfect, that the space and the items are going to be exactly what you want? Or is it also for a new perspective on old things?
Both. Like my friend Hugo and I'll go to his house and I'll help move his furniture around just for fun. It is, you know, I'll do it anywhere, you know. Just if you ask me, I'll do it. If I'm at your house and you want me.
My mom would love you. She loves to move her furniture around and, you know, try to have new spaces with the same old space. It's like, I think every like 2 months, she's like trying to get my dad to move the sofas and all of that stuff. You'd have a good time over there.
Okay.
Where do you, she's in the Bay Area in Oakland in an old English Tudor house. Nice. Not Tudor though. I don't know what you would call it. It looks like a cottage. It looks like it's from a storybook. Okay. Yeah.
I think the same things are happening with me where I like the idea of being in a new environment. So you're changing it, but then I kind of want the environment to be at its best. And I want all the furniture to work. Just like that table in Provincetown for 12 years, it wasn't the right table.
Mm-hmm. And you don't like paint colors? Are you more of a purist, neutral, light?
I'm kind of neutral. Luckily in Provincetown, there was a bunch of old wallpaper here that had enough patina that made it look nice. And I did some wallpapers with Pierre Frey and Designers Guild. Some are in the house too. So I do like some print and pattern. But yeah, I'm not good. Steven's really good with colors, my partner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, a lot of the things you sell have color.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like the things I have strong amounts of color, even the throws and the plates I make. So that sort of.
Do you want things to look old?
I do like old things, so I guess, yeah. I'm doing a new series of plates where I got all these 18th century plates in which we had professionally photographed, and we're making decoupage look just like them. So if there's chips and cracks, the plates, it'll have the chip and the crack in it. So I love the idea. I love the humor in that. I also like kind of I think I find the charm of it. I also like feel like I'm a bit maybe prankstery. Like I like the fake fake parts of things. Like I have a lot of fake food and fake candles and fake flowers in the shop. And I like it sometimes when the whole plate is an image, like it looks like a shell, but it's like, oh, it's a shell, but it's not a shell. I do like playing with that.
But what do you think it is that you want to look around in your space and have things that are not new looking?
What do I think it is?
Yeah. Is it emotional? Is it something, your connection to a past or something?
I think yes. Something I'm connected to in the past, I guess. Don't know.
Yeah. Well, do you also do design? Like, will you do interiors on assignment for clients?
No, I don't have the time to do that. Mm-hmm. I actually also feel like I'm so specific in style. Like, if you want it to look like my house, I could do that. But other than that, I don't think I could really help too much.
What about when you're doing your own space? I saw you had this incredible, and I don't know how to describe it, but this huge wooden structure that you put on your wall. Like, oh, over, yeah. Yeah.
I got that in Antwerp. It was Swedish. It's a couple hundred years old. And I got it. And when it got shipped to America, my friend received it in Philadelphia. And it just stayed in his studio for, I think, like 18 years or something ridiculous. And I got an apartment. And I thought, oh, it'd be kind of fun to use that. I tried to use that wall in all this. You know, I had, since having that wall, I had three new stores. And I had renovated two apartments, and this is like another apartment. And then all of a sudden it fit my apartment by, like, it was off by an inch. It was pretty amazing. Like, and so my contractor just sort of built a wall behind it. And we used that as the wall in between the two spaces. So it has like two sets of double doors. Also in that apartment, I didn't like that the door opened right to the hallway, and there was no way to put like a curtain or something. So I had an antique cabinet, and I just had my contractor take the back out. And so we put that on the door. So when you're in the apartment, you just look like there was a cabinet, but it was actually the entrance to the apartment. So that was fun too, just to change your brain a little bit. So you were no longer sort of like out in the hallway or just in the apartment and then there's a piece of furniture. And then all of a sudden, every once in a while, I would trick somebody. It was really rewarding. I don't know why.
Well, in New York too, you're always problem solving. There's no like ideal space, unless you're maybe in a new building, but you're always like dealing with something that you have to kind of trick people or work around or make something of it that's less than ideal. Do you do all of that yourself? It's just literally you, and then you have the contractor just facilitate your idea?
Yeah, I have a good friend, my friend Kevin Thompson. He was an architect. He does production design now for films. And all the last three stores and a few apartments have purchased or rented or whatever. He's come with me and helped walk me through the spaces. And I'm like, this is what I think we could do. And he's very, he's got a clear mind and supportive. He lets me do what I want, but then helps kind of guide me a little bit. And then from that, I work with my contractor, who I've worked with a bunch of times. This guy, his company is called Miracle Man. He's great. He's just like, he communicates well. He gets me. I like working with him.
And do you do any of it yourself?
No, like hammering and.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but I feel like hammer and nails and scotch tape are the things I use the most, basically. Because
what do you mean?
Well, because I'm forever hanging things. And then in my own studio, when I'm mocking up things, I use a lot of scotch tape. Just when I'm working on ideas and stuff like that.
Have your aesthetics and taste evolved?
I hope so in some ways, but it's still authentic to me, this world that I live in that I don't know how I got here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would you ever look back though at your 20-year-old self and go, oh my God, I would never do that now. I'm so much more evolved.
Yeah. It really was a magical life. When I look back, I'm like, all those weird jobs that I had made no sense. But then once I got my, when I started my company and opened a store, all that stuff seemed to suddenly make sense to me. You know, like working mm-hmm. with the public, working in the restaurant, like it gave me skills that I, you know, I needed for when I had the store. And it's, like I was saying, like somebody was guiding me. I don't know who, but somehow it all worked out. And so I don't really have regrets in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
It all kind of went, even though it's some, there were a few times when I was working sort of in a restaurant, like I can't work here anymore. I have to do something more creative or focus more on my creative side. And then I did make some decisions. Cause I was working like one day a week in a store on Saturdays that sold some home goods and gifts in Boston called La Ruche. And then I ended up working there full time.
Have you ever felt burned out or creatively like bereft of ideas?
A little bit these last couple of years, just because I've had so much else to deal with. But I would say this last 6 months have been a billion times better. Like I feel like I've been in my studio more and making things. So it's
but
been,
do you have a process for creating things? Like you go on a walk, or you go on an inspiration trip, or anything you do when it's not maybe necessarily just coming easily?
Like I was saying earlier, we do spend a lot of time in nature here, so I am inspired by that. I don't know what that means. Sometimes I am inspired by it, but I feel like there's a sense of wonder here, especially on the Cape, where in the woods, we're sort of like, look at that plant, look at that bug, look at that animal. You know, I love it all. And I think that's how I relate to the imagery that I use. Like I feel I'm still charmed and amazed and full of wonder at the things that I find and see. And I think that's about why I share those things. Even I did that book I did in 2016, was a great experience for me. It was one of the smoothest and most fun things I've ever done, collaboration wise. And I'm doing another book. I'm going to do book two. But the funny thing about it was my agent was like, well, they want to do it, but you need to get the stuff done by X date. And I spent the weekend in my studio looking around thinking, how could I not want everyone to see all these images? It was sort of like where it came from was just, again, kind of sharing. And so I felt like, okay, that's a good sign. It's all a good thing. It's coming from a good place. I want to do another book. And so that's what I've been working on.
And how did you get Anna Wintour to write the foreword for your book? And that is no easy feat, not to mention, like, that's not something you can have an assistant write for you. She had to sit down and actually write that out of her busy schedule.
Funny, she does mention me moving around furniture in Hugo's house because she's friends with Hugo, too. She just became a good customer of the shop. And then because of Hugo Guinness, this friend, artist I represent, somehow they had a connection, and then she likes his work, and then we all became, you know, I became friendlier. And I just was trying to think, when the book came out, I was just thinking who would be sort of more neutral. Like I just didn't, anyway, so I thought she was my first thought. And so I asked, and she was like, sure. So
you asked her personally?
Yes.
That seems scary.
No, she's always been great and nice. I have to say, like, sometimes I feel like in the very beginning, like I was just like working, going, doing, you know, sometimes I'm just like getting things done. People come in the store, you know, and she came in and I didn't know who she was at first. And then, so I was just sort of like, you know, bantering and witty and showing her things around. And then all of a sudden I kind of realized, and then I just felt like I started in a good place, like where I didn't necessarily, wasn't intimidated by her in any way. So it was good.
I'm sure that she felt that too. You know, it's probably refreshing.
Yeah.
But what was the last big thing that you splurged on? Or is there something in the home that you, now that you're, you know, successful and doing your thing, that you would be like, okay, I'm going to splurge on this?
I was like, not much I can think of. I when I was in the south of France last year, I bought this giant World War I tarp that went over a truck, like a military tarp, and I just had a chair covered in it. It's my new favorite thing. It's like this weird dark gray, has some holes in it, and I had like an antique chair and I just had it covered in.
That's so cool.
It is. I love it. But other than that, no, I haven't really closed every once in a while, but I'm not really a close.
What about like a kitchen range? Would you buy like a Wolf or a Lacanche? Yourself? Is that important to you?
It's funny because I did get in 2020, at the very beginning of COVID, I bought an apartment. It was kind of like the worst thing to be doing at that time. And it had a Sub-Zero refrigerator and a nice old stove. And I was just like, they're in good shape. So why get a new one? So I'm not splurging yet on anything for that apartment.
They last forever.
They're so
expensive, but they last forever. I think the fridge.
Yeah, I think it's from 97. And the guy that came to look at it is like, if you can keep this forever, try to keep it forever. It's better than new ones. So anyways, it's been working out great. But I haven't really splurged yet on anything.
Well, for me, like if I was going to buy a sofa from you or like a armoire or something, that would be a splurge.
Yes.
You can just go in your store and get anything you want.
That's not true. I have to buy it. No, it is funny how I all kind of moves, how it does shift. I can't think of it. More of a clothes item if I was going to splurge on something. But then I don't necessarily, I'm moving around, sorry. Then I haven't really planned. I have nothing in the near future, splurge-wise.
Yeah. Do you go on inspiration trips?
No, I just hopefully go on trips that inspire me.
What about, like, you were saying earlier, like, Morocco, you have blankets from there. Will you go there and source things and look for product?
Oh, yeah, I have. I had a house. I rented a house with some friends there for 5 years in Marrakesh, so I went more regularly. And there are a few things that I sell in the shop that we get in Morocco, these floor mats, some rugs.
Oh, yeah, but, like, how do you find the things that you end up selling?
I have a good friend that lives in Marrakesh, and she has some good sources, and she has a shop. And so every time I go, she has like a new rug dealer for me to meet, that kind of thing.
Wow.
Just friends.
This is a question that I ask everyone near the end of the podcast, is if you could go back in time and meet yourself somewhere, when would it be and what would you say?
I feel like this is like the end of a RuPaul Drag Race thing when they just say, mm-hmm. What would you say to your little Johnny? It's going to be okay. The funny thing about it, this whole thing is there's a sense of me that's always been there. Like somehow I believed in myself in a way, even though I was against all odds, like against my family, against school, against my town. Like I just somehow I believed in myself, but I'm not quite sure how or why. But I still have this sort of thing that has kept me going. I'm just saying all that because I'm like, would I go back to my youth to say something? I don't know. I don't know. It's a huge, big question. And mm-hmm. Where do I go?
But you do feel like you did overcome things.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely feel like I overcame things, and I definitely had sort of bullied, not the best childhood and schooling. I mean, definitely spent a lot of time and enjoyed every second of it by myself. Even though I'm the youngest of six, my brothers would be off playing, and I'd be like under a porch building this or in an attic. You know, I was content. I didn't. It wasn't until like a little later that I realized, like, oh, maybe I'm a little weird, and I'm, you know, other kids. I wasn't really socializing as much, and that was difficult. So maybe I could go to back to when I was 11 and be like, it's gonna be okay.
Mm-hmm. You're gonna make it. Here's a little, just a quick fun game to wrap things up. It's this is made just for you, John Darien. If money were no object, okay. It's like, you get it. You don't have to pay for it. Would you put heated floors in your bathroom?
No.
Yeah. Would you have, if money were no object, would you have a home movie theater?
Maybe. I watched a lot of movies as a kid. That was my escape too.
Mm-hmm. I can't picture you in one of those like McMansion with the home theater and a popcorn machine on the side.
No popcorn machine.
Okay. But we'll give you the big
bar. But a couple of velvet seats, you know, maybe four or something.
Not as long big. As it's tasteful.
Comfortable.
What about all marble and gold bathroom?
Never. I mean, I like marble, but.
Yeah. Home cryo pool?
Interesting, but no.
What about a Japanese Toto toilet?
No.
No. You're really so old-fashioned.
I'm not fussy.
Would you rather live in a 15,000 square foot McMansion in Bumblefuck or a 1,000 square foot pre-war walk-up in NoHo?
What's the first one?
15,000 square foot McMansion in Bumblefuck, Idaho, let's say.
Well, I don't necessarily want to be in a McMansion, but I'm not sure if I want to be in a pre-war walk-up either. No. I like it a little older. Maybe, you know, early 1800s somewhere.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I guess we'll give you that one.
Okay.
When it comes to decorating, people should spend more money on blank.
Furniture? Sorry, I wouldn't even know. What do you spend more money on? Appliances.
Versus something cheap that people buy things that are cheap and like they don't spend the extra money on.
Oh, yeah. I would definitely, I have to say, like, invest in everything you buy. Like, when I was getting the sinks and stuff for the house, I was talking to my friend Joanne Rossman. She has a shop in Roslindale, Mass. And I said, oh, I got this sink, but it could be like $5,000. And she's like, buy it. I was like, okay.
Well, that's your splurge. Hello.
That was 20 years ago.
I love it. You're like, I don't know. I just never really splurge on anything unless you count the $5,000 marble sink.
I thought you meant splurge now. Like what I splurge on now. Sorry. Yes.
No. I'm giving you a hard time, John.
I definitely overspent on those sinks, but they're long lasting and worth it.
They last forever if you can afford it. Mm-hmm. When it comes to decorating, people should spend less money on blank.
You really got them. Less money on what? Well, I mean, they don't want you to junk up your house with junky things, but that doesn't really answer that question, does it?
Well, it does. I mean, like fast fashion furniture, you know?
Right. I just still feel like investing in things that are, you know, good, long-lasting are important. But I don't have an answer. Pass. Sorry.
Pass. What's your least favorite design genre?
Ooh. What can I look at? Well, I could just say like 70s paneling, lowered ceilings. That's not really a design genre, but
yeah, no, that's
still still scarring.
Okay, yeah. You don't want. They had really good 70s though. Did you watch Love and Death?
No.
On HBO, they had really good late 70s. It's a really good series, but they had really good Texas late 70s homes. I mean, not that you would want to live in it, but like the avocado and the rust caramels and like the carpeting, and it was really good.
Cool, sounds good.
Kind of peek into that time.
I do like it all. People are always like, "Oh, you won't like my house because it's modern." I'm like, I like all houses. I like how people live. I when I'm in those environments, I definitely adjust and enjoy it. I don't fight that stuff.
Right. What's the most played song you have on your phone?
I don't really have a song, but I do have this funny station that I created on Pandora that I just typed in. It was a song called "I Want to Be Bad." I want to be bad. Boop boop boop. Anyways, it's like a 20s playlist, and it's very funny. And a lot of things, a lot of songs end with like, "That's all," or it's a lot of boop boop doo. I don't know what it's about, but it's been giving me pleasure for like the last 3 years.
Okay, I'm going to check it out. I don't know it. What's the best series or movie that you've seen in the past few years?
I love Baghdad, Berlin. No, it's not what it's called.
Yeah. Babylon, Berlin.
Babylon, Berlin. That was a great series. I would say that one. The style that those, the production design was amazing. Those rooms, the furniture.
Wait, what are you listening to now?
Nothing, sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
But when I went to go look up the station, it just started playing. Sorry.
I was like, well, maybe it's Britney Spears. I love Babylon Berlin. I think it was such a great show, and I loved all the hair, makeup, styling, furniture,
yeah.
All of the William Morris. Why does that?
I also love the characters. How like here's a woman. Like in most shows, if you're like have sex for money or something, you're gonna be like the bad person the whole time. But this person like had to survive, and she had. You know, I like that the characters were multidimensional in a sense, and you kind of
totally. The only issue with it was like you could not blink or you would not be able to follow. I had to like Google world history to like sometimes after the episode to be like, okay, what happened? You know,
yeah.
And what's the best week to visit P Town?
I would say maybe the first week in September. It's a little quieter because it gets pretty crazy. It really depends on who you are. This week is 4th of July is a fun week, and it's a very different crowd, sort of younger and more fit. And then there's like a bear week, and there's a family week.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say bear week.
No, it's fun. They all have a lot of fun. But if your average person is going to come here, I think September is better. The weather's good. The water's still nice.
Can you swim in the water up there? Is it warm enough?
Oh, yeah. We start swimming in May. Crazy.
Oh, wow. That's why you don't want a cryo pool. You just go in the water in Massachusetts.
Exactly. We do it high tide every day at the breakwater, which is this like jetty at the end of town. High tide today is 11:55.
Nice. And you also have a shop up in P-Town, which must be really nice for locals to decorate their homes.
Yes. I opened it when I got the house, just because I thought maybe I needed to have that here, and it's worked out okay.
Awesome. Well, John, this has been a pleasure to talk to you. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of your work. I love your stores. I love your aesthetic, following you on Instagram.
Thank you.
And thank you for sharing and opening up with me today.
Yeah, great. Quinn, thank you so much for reaching out. And I've never done anything like this, so I feel like, 100 questions I could ask you. Which I haven't asked you one question about you.
You can ask me one question. What would it be?
When you were a little kid, were you doing makeup as a young child, as a young boy? What were you doing as a young boy?
Well, you know what? I have an older sister, and I remember dressing up as a girl, she did her nails. I wanted mine done.
Yeah.
And when we were really little, my mom was going to take my sister to the mall to get her ears pierced. And, my mom's Italian, like the Italians pierce their kids' ears way earlier than American wasp. So we were at the mall. My sister was crying because she was afraid to get her ears pierced. And then Ice was crying because my mom wouldn't let me get my ears pierced. Mm-hmm. So that kind of says it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cute. Yeah. Because sometimes people are like, don't know what to do with their lives. And I'm like, I've been doing the same thing my whole life. What did you do as a kid? And then they're like, I did this. I was like, well, that sounds great. Maybe you could.
I have two modes in my life where I either don't know what I want to do with my life, and it feels very painful and frustrating, but I'm growing a ton. And then I'm in the part where I'm doing it, and it's, that's great and thrilling. And now I learn to cherish those moments, but I forever will have this back and forth of doing something, them wanting more, painful, do it. It's just how I am.
Yeah. I mean, being curious is commendable, and talking to people and understanding people and seeing how people, what makes people tick is interesting.
And it's also self-serving. Like, if you really know me and you hear the questions that I ask people in the episodes, it's all about me on some level. You know what I mean? Like, everything I'm asking you is a projection and me trying to figure out more about myself. So, like, I feel like I don't even need my own episode. If you just listen to, like, what I'm asking people, you'll know who I am.
Interesting.
Yeah. All right. Well, have a great 4th of July.
Thank you.
We'll be in touch.
Okay. Quinn, thanks so
much. Take
care. You too.
Bye.
Bye.